Welcome to the No Illusions podcast. My name is Cameron Riley. Happy 2010, folks. Recording this on the 26th of January 2010, my first No Illusions podcast for the year. Recording it on what most people refer to as Australia Day. I refer to it as Happy Genocide Day, the day when the Christians came and started a 200-year genocide of the indigenous population of Australia. Don't get much mention of that in the mainstream press, but I think it's something we should all be thinking about, and our responsibility to the indigenous populations of the various countries that we Westerners today live in. What are we doing for them? Is it working? And if not, what should we be doing differently? Haven't done a podcast on this show for a long time. Been working with Peter Elliard on the Peter Elliard Show. Before we get into today's topic, and by the way, today there's no guest. This is just going to be me talking about a bunch of stuff that's been on my mind lately. Probably going to do a lot more of that this year, my fifth year of podcasting. Well, maybe my sixth, considering I started G'day World at the end of 2004, around November-ish, and this is now 2010. So I've been doing this thing for a long time. Lately, one of the reasons I haven't done many shows is, apart from working on the stuff with Peter, I've been, doing a lot of consulting, trying to make ends meet, trying to pay the bills, do a lot of social media, digital strategy consulting for a variety of people. I have a range of clients now that I'm doing that for. That's keeping me very busy. Very exciting stuff. You know, after running TPN for the last 5 years and finding it very hard to make money out of what we do here, it's been really interesting to get involved in doing digital strategy for people who sell real products and have real revenues and can actually make real money. And the plan that I have for TPN over the next couple of years is to continue to do that work, generate some serious revenues out of that, and use that to fund the next 5 years of TPN in conjunction with the people who are the executive producers of TPN, the patrons, Tony Kynaston and Neo.org, Billy Out, Neo.org. Want to thank those guys again for their support over the recent months, which will hopefully continue this year. That enables me to cover the basic running costs of TPN, the technology and the IT guys, which is the biggest out of pocket outside of my own salary. It's good, which without them, I probably wouldn't be able to keep TPN on the air. Also, the plan for TPN this year, while I'm on the subject, is I'm going to be working a lot more closely with Peter Elliard around this thing that he's setting up, Foundation 2050, based on the book Designing 2050 that he wrote, I published last year. And Foundation 2050 is designed to be like the XPRIZE. We want to create an investment fund that can act as a prize pool for innovators and inventors who develop the technologies that Peter envisioned in Designing 2050 that he believes we need to focus on in order to design a more sustainable, prosperous and harmonious world by the year 2050. So TPN's going to be working with Peter to, be the media arm of that, looking at all of the innovations, both technological and political, socio-economical innovations that we need to build a more sustainable, harmonious world. But this is the No Illusion Show. Obviously, it used to be G'day World, now the No Illusion Show, where the basic premise of this show, if you're listening for the first time, is to have a look at what's going on in the world today and really let's try to have a frank discussion about it. Let's not have any illusions about who we really are, what we're really doing, and what's really going on in the world today. Let's try and cut through the propaganda that we get in the media and from our governments and from big corporations and try and get to the heart of what's really going on out there. And of course, probably the big thing that the biggest thing that's rocked the world over the last couple of weeks at the beginning of 2010 is the earthquake in Haiti. As I said, I'm recording this on the 26th. of January 2010, and I think currently the death toll in Port-au-Prince alone is estimated by the Haitian government as being in the vicinity of 150,000 people, which is a crazy number and just horrifying. And the other number that's really, really shocked me is in the 11 days that the international search and rescue operation took place in Haiti, only 132 people were rescued. 132 people. And it's just such a minuscule number. It's quite shocking. Of course, you know, a lot of those search and rescue operations were providing much needed medical care, medical supplies to people who had been injured by the earthquake and weren't necessarily trapped under the rubble, but received broken bones and internal damage, and without the assistance of these teams would may have perished. But still, 132 people is shocking. Of course, if you've been following my tweets over the course of the last couple of weeks, you see that one of my big concerns for Haiti is the amount of troops that the United States has sent there. And I want to talk for a few minutes about that, try and provide some background for my concern. Had quite a few debates on Twitter about this over the last couple of weeks. The first thing that we need to understand to put this in context is the relationship between Haiti and the United States over the course of the last century. You know, again, whenever we're looking at things that are happening in the modern world today, whether it's Haiti or Iran or China or the United States even, we need to start by providing context. We need to look at the history of those countries, the relationships between the various geopolitical powers, to start to create a framework for understanding what might be happening there today and why it might be happening. Now, this is something that the mainstream media doesn't really do. When you read about what's going on in these various countries, the mainstream media quite often neglects to provide any historical context for what's happening. But I've found in the last decade or so, as I've been thinking about these situations, that historical context can quite often be one of the most important pieces of information that you can pull together. So let's have a look at some of the history between the United States and Haiti, those voodoo-loving beings, as Pat Robertson, the crazy motherfucker Christian evangelical, might refer to them as. And we'll put that into perspective. I'm going to start by quoting from a man called Smedley Darlington Butler. Now, General Butler lived from 1881 to 1940. He was nicknamed the Fighting Quaker and Old Gimlet Eye. He was a major general in the U.S. Marine Corps, and at the time of his death was the most decorated Marine in U.S. history. Now, Major General Butler is quoted as saying, "I spent years being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 02 to 12. This is 1902 to 1912. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 16. I brought light to Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 16. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for National City bank boys to collect revenue in. I helped in the rape of a half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street." That quote is in Noam Chomsky's 1985 book, Turning the Tide. So as we can see, the interest in Haiti, along with a variety of other Central American and Latin American countries, goes back a long time, the American interest in them, to turn them into places where there were resources that America could help itself to, and also where it could create cheap labor and also a market for some of its products and services. So this isn't anything new. This interest in Haiti has been going on a long time. So the Americans have basically controlled Haiti since around about 1915. They, you know, directly occupied Haiti from 1915 until 1934. Basically, the history behind this is the American president Woodrow Wilson sent about 330 U.S. Marines to Port-au-Prince on July 28, 1915, to basically, quote-unquote, protect American and foreign interests. There'd been a lot of revolt going on in Haiti at the time, and there were quite a few American businesses trading in there. There was a bank that had been set up there. The National City Bank of New York had gone in and acquired control of the Banque Nationale de Haiti, the nation's only commercial bank, and the government treasury back in sort of 1910, 1911. It was a bunch of American investors that were backed by the State Department. And so Wilson decided, in order to protect American interests, there was also a growing German influence in Haiti around about the time, and obviously World War I just broken out. So yeah, the Americans basically went in and literally took control of Haiti using the Marines and controlled it then for the next 19 years. It was basically under military occupation, well beyond World War I and almost right up until World War II. But they finally pulled out under Franklin Roosevelt. And there was a period then where there was some democracy, there was some coup d'etats, a bunch of things went on for the next 20, 25 years. Up until 1957, when François Duvalier, a.k.a. Papa Doc, as he was known, became the dictator of Haiti. Now, he was an American puppet dictator. He had gone to university at the University of Michigan, had been involved with a variety of campaigns funded by the U.S. He was a doctor, actually. That's why he had the nickname Papa Doc. And there were some U.S.-funded campaigns to get rid of tropical diseases like typhus and yaws and malaria out of Haiti. But when he took control, he became a really brutal dictator, and the Duvalier family basically ran Haiti then for the next 30-odd years. The United States, particularly under Jack Kennedy, had a bit of a difficult relationship with Duvalier. In fact, when Kennedy was assassinated, Duvalier claimed that it was the result of a curse that he had placed on him. But, of course, around about the same time, Cuba, which is right next door to Haiti, went through the revolution, was moving rapidly towards communism after the revolution. And the Americans under LBJ and onwards decided that Duvalier was sort of better than communism. So they basically supported his incredibly brutal dictatorial rule over Haiti for the next several decades. And this guy created something called the Tonton Macoutes. The Tonton Macoutes was like a militia that roamed around Haiti, basically killing everyone that spoke out against the Duvalier government and was perceived to be a threat or traitorous to the government. There's a suggestion that there was something like 30,000 people killed by the Macoutes over a period of years. It was a very brutal rule, but again, supported by the Americans, because they thought it would be better than communism. I mean, the things that America has justified again as a way of staving off communism in the last 50, 60 years is just really hard to believe. And of course, the fear that America had about communism during the latter part of the 20th century was all about the threat that communism posed to the wealthy elite of America. I mean, if communism had proven to be a successful socioeconomic system anywhere in the world, it may have, you know, gained an even bigger foothold, and it may have started to actually, it could have even ended up as popular in the United States. Obviously, it was popular in the United States for a long time, which is why they had to have the Red Scare and the blacklist and those sorts of things. But of course, from the viewpoint of the wealthy elite in America, they didn't want anyone messing with capitalism. They liked the system they have, where 1% of the population controls 99% of the wealth. And communism, socialism posed a threat to that way of life in the 20th century, particularly the late 20th century. So anytime the people of a country started to move towards communism, or a leader would move towards communism, basically what happened is the Americans would send in the CIA to have that government removed, and they would install in their place somebody who they thought would be a nice puppet. And in cases like Duvalier, where they found a brutal dictator who was the complete opposite of communism, who was all about himself and his family and their wealth, the United States were happy to support that. Anything but communism, basically, was their motto during that period, probably still is today. Now, as I mentioned before, when I was quoting American crackpot evangelical Pat Robertson, where he was talking about voodoo in Haiti, this whole association between Haiti and voodoo actually comes in a large part from Duvalier. He really revived the traditions of voodoo and claimed himself to be a voodoo priest. Now, if you've ever read anything about voodoo, you'll know that there's sort of a character called Baron Samedi, S-A-M-E-D-I. He's like the god of the dead, effectively, as far as I understand it. I'm not claiming to be an expert in voodoo. Duvalier basically modeled himself, his image, on Baron Samedi. This was the history up until Duvalier died in 1971, and then his 19-year-old son, Jean-Claude Duvalier, a.k.a. Baby Doc, became the new president. And he was the president until 1986. Now, Baby Doc was as brutal as his father was, and even more irresponsible. He basically drove the country into the ground economically, maintained control of taxes on tobacco, and basically threw all of them into his private slush fund, and literally drove the country into an economic black hole while, you know, lining his own pockets. Finally, though, Baby Doc just became so completely out of control, and it became so well known that even the Reagan administration needed to distance itself from him. So in 1986, there was some pressure to have him removed. A little bit of a scuffle, but he ended up leaving Haiti, moved to France, where he still lives today. Supposedly, he lives modestly in Paris, but after the recent earthquake, he announced that he was going to transfer $8 million US to the American Red Cross to help with the earthquake. So he's obviously doing okay. So, you know, and this is quite often the way with these brutal dictators that are supported by the Americans over the last 50 years, when finally they're just so completely out of control, raping the country and killing people, and the Americans can't hide it anymore. You know, they send them off to live somewhere, either in the US or somewhere in Europe, and they have a big bucket of money that they took from the people. And they just live peacefully forever after retirees. And that, unfortunately, is the case with Baby Doc Duvalier. Okay, so after Baby Doc, there was a brief period where they had a military government for a couple of years under General Namphy. Then they had Professor Leslie Manigat becoming president, but he was kicked out by the military. And then finally, in December 1990, there was a democratic election that international observers said were free and fair. And a Roman Catholic priest, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, A-R-I-S-T-I-D-E, I don't know how to pronounce that in French, Aristide, became the president. Now, he had some pretty radical populist policies, and as a result, the elite basically had him removed in 1991. A fairly violent coup. It's estimated that about 5,000 Haitians were killed, and about 50,000 Haitians tried to flee to the United States, most of which were denied entry and sent back to Haiti. Aristide himself, Aristide, accused the United States of backing the 1991 coup. And this military regime that did the coup ran the country for the next couple of years. But then in 1994, Aristide was brought back with some help from Bill Clinton, who sent Jimmy Carter in to negotiate. And the US sent an army basically to go in and enter Haiti for something they call Operation Uphold Democracy. So the military leaders agreed to step down, and Aristide was allowed to return. But, you know, it kind of reminds me of the situation we've seen with Zelaya in Honduras over the course of the last year, where you had a guy who was popularly elected, was putting into place policies that were not in the interests of the wealthy elite of that country and the US elite, was removed by a political coup, and then after a period of time had passed where he was in exile, his return was engineered supposedly by the United States. They look like the heroes. They look like the good guys. But, you know, call me a cynic, but I think the history of the CIA in the last 60 years gives me good reason to be cynical about anything the US is involved in when it comes to overthrowing democratically elected presidents of countries. I have to wonder, when these guys are in exile, what kind of deals are done to get the US to return them to their country. There's got to be some backroom machinations that go on where there's some quid pro quo discussions. I do for you, you do for me. You know how it goes. In fact, Aristide himself claims that in a 2006 interview, he said the US went back on their word regarding compromises he made with them over privatization of enterprises to ensure that part of the profits would go to the Haitian people. And then they used a disinformation campaign to discredit him. Now, what he was accused of over the next 10 years of his presidency was everything from drug trafficking to, mass murder to, embezzlement, corruption, money laundering, all sorts of things. So he was then removed by the Americans on an American airplane, escorted by American diplomats and military, and was flying to Africa, and where he has basically been ever since, but is trying to return to the country, particularly after the last election, the earthquake. He said he wanted to return to help his people, but he's not allowed to return to the country. They had elections that were won by René Préval, and he's been running it for the last few years. Now, one of the other things that's interesting when you look at what's happening in Haiti at the moment is the suggestion that there are large oil reserves underneath the country. And we'll talk about that next time.